and share with us. Dr. Anderson is known to most of you. He's been here at VCBC before. This is my first time to meet him, though, but we appreciate him taking the time to come and to share with us. Dr. Anderson is on the faculty of Oklahoma Baptist University. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And you're a doctor, so do you see patients? Or?
Well, I need patients.
Okay.
But
no, not that kind of doctor.
No, not that kind of doctor. You want to go to Wigwan for that.
For those kind of problems. So Wigwan will set up a room off to the side there. Any consultations you need this morning? In case you were expecting that kind of medical care this morning? No, we won't do that. So how did you get, you were telling me that you're from Alberta. How do you, someone from Alberta get down to Oklahoma?
Well, the short answer is that God's got a sense of humor.
Okay.
When God called me to go back to school, pursue a PhD, I did my doctorate in Kentucky. And that kind of opened doors to applying for jobs, not just in Canada, but also in the States. And lo and behold, when graduation came, I applied for 52. We kept count, 52 different academic jobs, and was only interviewed at one place, and that was OBU. And actually, of all the jobs that I applied for, it was the one that fit me best to begin with. And so that's the way that God kind of brought us there.
Okay, how long have you been there?
4 years now.
4 years, okay.
Yeah.
So you did your doctorate at the University of Kentucky, or where was it?
No, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. Yeah.
Okay, and what was the title of your thesis?
Thesis was The Myth of the Metaphorical Resurrection. It was an examination of John Dominic Crossan's methodology and conclusions.
Okay, did you get that? Are you taking notes? You can Google that to see if it's there on Amazon.
Oh, no, you can actually read it online for free. Yeah.
Oh, you don't even have to pay for it, better.
That's right.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. You're married?
Yep.
Okay, is your wife here?
Well, she's here in the city. She's about 5 minutes away or so at Aaron and Yolanda's house. And two of my kids were still sleeping when we left this morning. So.
I totally get that. My wife and kids are often like, we hear Dad talk all the time. Why would we want to go and hear him talk again?
Yep.
So, yeah, I totally understand that. Let's see. Sports, favorite sport?
Hockey.
You get a lot of that in Oklahoma?
No.
No? Okay. Does Oklahoma, do they have any kind of hockey?
Well, they used to have the Oilers farm team.
Oh, they did?
In Oklahoma City. Yeah. So we got to watch them, but they just folded this year. They're moving out to Bakersfield, California. So
of course, no more
professional hockey in Oklahoma.
So the Oilers are your hockey team then?
Yes.
Okay. Good. And let's get to know Dr. Anderson a little bit more. Coke or Pepsi?
Neither.
Neither?
Root beer.
Okay. Root beer. Oh, good man. Yeah, thank you. Cat or dog?
Neither. They both make me sick.
Oh, sorry. Allergic.
Allergy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's enough for now. I think we will be taking a break. There's two sessions this morning, so we'll leave it up to you. So whenever you feel free. So about halfway, I guess. I'll let you handle it from here, how you want to handle questions and that sort of thing. So
over
to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pastor Gilbert. It's nice to meet you. Of course, new from my time here last year. Thank you again for being here on a Saturday morning. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm excited to be here. Yolanda asked me this morning, are you excited? Or maybe it was Aaron. I don't remember. It was early. And I said, yeah, I'm excited. So I look forward to being able to share, to being able to dialogue and just talk with one another as well. Feel free, if you'd like, to move closer to the front so I can see you better. I'm getting blind in my old age, so the better I can see you, the better. We're going to talk about two different things this morning, so two very different sessions. This first session, I want to talk about the relationship between faith and reason. My kind of general goal will be to kind of talk through things. This is going to be really, really rapid and kind of surface level. We're not going to be able to dive deep into a lot. So the Q&A time might be where we can pick at different points that we want to go in a little more depth into. And so I'll try to talk for probably, I'd say, about 40 minutes, and then we'll leave kind of 20, 30 minutes for some dialogue time, and then we'll take a quick break and come back. Does that sound about right? That should wrap us up at about 12:15. Was that about the goal? Yeah? Okay. If you're getting tired of me talking, just kind of wave your hand at me, and I'll wrap up, and we can move right to Q&A. I'm happy to do that. My students do it to me all the time. They say, Dr. Anderson, you're getting boring. Can we talk? I'm like, yes, we can talk. But I want to talk first this morning about the relationship again between faith and reason. You should have a handout. The handout will give you kind of an outline of where we want to go. I like outlines simply for the purpose when I'm in your shoes of helping me to stay awake and to stay focused. If you don't need outlines to help you do that, that's okay. But if you're somewhat like me, somewhat distractible squirrel, then handouts can be a very helpful kind of thing. So I want to talk about the perception that is very prevalent in our society that Christianity is an unreasonable faith, that to believe the tenets of Christianity require you to set aside intellectual credibility and rationality, to rely on blind faith instead of on reason and evidence. Many, even within the Christian church, have either consciously or unconsciously embraced this kind of a perspective that Christianity is about just faith and not reason, that faith and reason are enemies or at least strangers. So some will say that Christian preaching relies on appeal to emotion and rhetoric or manipulation and brainwashing, while those who are skeptical of Christianity are guided by unbiased reason and scientific investigation. So my desire this morning is to show that this perspective is mistaken, that Christian faith and reason are friends, even allies, in the search for truth. And so to dive into that, first I want to look at some of the accusations of irrationality that are launched against Christianity in particular and against religion in general. So over about the past 12 or 15 years, the Western world has seen the rise of a so-called new atheism. How many of you have heard of the new atheism? One, two, a handful of you? Okay. Some of the thinkers like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, these are some of the figures that are important in what they call the new atheism. And they're perceived as being different than an old atheism in a couple of ways. First, they are fairly militant, even evangelistic, in seeking to share their faith, their beliefs, to promote their beliefs. Second, they are not content to set atheism alongside other belief systems, other worldviews, as mutually respectable options. Instead, for new atheists, there is something inherently evil with religious faith, such that it is wrong morally and intellectually to be a religious believer. Now, first, let's set the historical record straight. There's really nothing new about the new atheism, despite the fact they call themselves new atheists. It's not new. W.K. Clifford wrote in 1877 that, and I quote, "It is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence." This phrase, famously known as Clifford's evidentialist maxim, insists that religious believers are immoral for taking their beliefs on faith instead of on evidence. The French anti-Christian Voltaire wrote, "Faith consists in believing when it is beyond the power of reason to believe." So we have examples prior to our own generation of skeptics who insisted that religious beliefs are ungrounded and unreasonable. But if nothing else, the rise of new atheism has brought a militant brand of atheism to the cultural mainstream of our generation. You go to many universities and they will be reading the textbooks by Dennett, Dawkins, Harris, Hitchens. This will be part of their general reading. So let's look briefly at some of the accusations launched against Christianity in particular. Now, I know you can't read the text on this one, so I apologize for that. I'm just going to talk through a little bit of it briefly. Richard Dawkins is probably the world's foremost evolutionary biologist, teaches at Oxford University, and he argues that religion is evil on two accounts. First, religion is based on faith, which Dawkins defines as belief in something without evidence. So remember that definition. We're going to come back to it throughout this morning. The sin here is that a belief that is held without evidence cannot be overturned by rational argument or empirical evidence, and so such a belief is technically irrational. That is, it is neither formed nor defeasible by rational means. You can't use reason or evidence to overturn a belief that is based on not evidence. Second, he says religious faith leads directly to people committing atrocious evils in the name of their religious righteousness. So you have the 9/11 bombings, you have Northern Ireland, you have all of these evils that are perpetrated because people feel they are doing what is right in the eyes of their religion. Dawkins goes on in other writings to insist that people with religious beliefs are worthy of contempt, mockery, and ridicule. He explicitly, this is in a famous speech that he gave at the Reason for Rally in Washington, D.C. about 4 years ago. He explicitly identifies Christian beliefs as insane. So if you are a Christian here this morning, then Dawkins says that your beliefs are insane. We are so irrational, so unreasonable, and our beliefs are so indefensible and idiotic in his mind that the only proper response, he says, is one of dismissive derision, mockery, contempt. Last, from Dawkins, a letter to his 10-year-old daughter. He provides this advice. He says, the next time somebody tells you something that sounds important, think to yourself, is this the kind of thing that people probably know because of evidence? Or is it the kind of thing that people believe only because of tradition, authority, or revelation? And the next time somebody tells you that something is true, why not say to them, what kind of evidence is there for that? And if they can't give you a good answer, I hope you'll think very carefully before you believe a word they say. Now, his intent here is to remind his daughter that religious beliefs exist in the absence of evidence, and that if she were to ask a Christian what evidence they have for their beliefs, the believer would come up empty. They'd have nothing to say. So, Dawkins holds that faith is belief in the absence of evidence. Religious beliefs have to be taken on faith because there is no evidence to support them. Christianity is a religion of irrational faith, and Christian people are people of irrational faith, not reason. The second member of the New Atheists is the late Christopher Hitchens. I know you can't read this one either. I'm sorry. I didn't know how unreadable the text was until we put it up on the screen. So here are a couple of brief quotes from Hitchens. First, faith is the surrender of the mind, the surrender of reason, the surrender of the only thing that makes us different from other animals. It is our need to believe and to surrender our skepticism and our reason, our yearning to discard that and put all our trust or faith in someone or something. That is a sinister thing to me. Out of all the virtues, all the supposed virtues, faith is the most overrated. So it's interesting to note that Hitchens places skepticism and reason side by side as being basically the same thing. If you're a reasonable person, you'll be skeptical when it comes to things of religion. Again, we see the key contention. Faith is the enemy of reason. One last quote from his best-selling book, God is Not Great. Religion comes from that period of human prehistory where nobody had even the smallest idea what was going on. It comes from the bawling and fearful infancy of our species. Faith is a babyish attempt to meet our inescapable demand for knowledge, as well as for comfort, reassurance, and other infantile needs. Today, the least educated of my children knows much more about the natural order than any of the founders of religion. So the accusation against Christianity is that, in short, Christianity is irrational, unevidenced, and therefore both morally indefensible and rationally indefensible. Faith is belief without evidence. Religion stems from the surrender of the mind. Christians are required by the tenets of their religion to check their brains at the door in order to maintain their faith. Faith and reason are not friends, nor can they even be companions. At best, they are strangers. In reality, according to Dawkins and Hitchens, faith and reason are enemies, and reason is the only side worth siding with. So as followers of Christ, who I trust also desire to be thoughtful and reasonable people, how can we respond to these accusations that Christianity is unreasonable and Christians are irrational? I want to work through a first line of defense, and that needs to be demonstrating the reasonableness of Christians and their Christian faith. And as we do this, I want to recommend, it's on the back of your handout, three specific works to you. Timothy Keller has written a book called The Reason for God, where he methodically works through a number of common objections to Christianity, as well as setting forth some positive reasons to believe Christianity is true. The second one is by William Lane Craig. It's called Reasonable Faith. The third edition is the one that's worth getting. And he works through in a lot more detail the relationship between faith and reason, and also working through the reasons to believe. He's got two very, very, very lengthy chapters on arguments for the existence of God, arguments for the reality or the possibility of miracles, for historical knowledge, for the person of Jesus Christ, the work of Jesus Christ, and then finally a defense of the resurrection. And then the longest one, the most difficult read of the three, is Alvin Plantinga's Warranted Christian Belief, which is 500 pages long, and it's a very technical philosophical work. But in it, he attacks directly the accusation that Christianity is irrational. And he works through what exactly is this charge, where does it come from, and then how do we respond to it. So, if you find yourself wanting to read more on this topic of the relationship between reason and faith, and is Christianity reasonable, these are three places that you can start. Now, my goal in this section is to lay out a preliminary case for the reasonability of two aspects or doctrines of the Christian faith. First, the existence of a creator God, and second, the resurrection of Jesus. My intent is to demonstrate that there are good reasons to accept each of these elements of Christian faith. And by good reasons, I mean simply this, that one can construct strong, logical arguments supported by empirical evidence and rational intuitions in support of each of these doctrines, such that an unbiased person with properly functioning mind would be fully justified in embracing the conclusions of each argument, namely that God exists and that God created the universe out of nothing and that God raised Jesus from the dead. Okay, so does that kind of make sense? The goal that I have, I want to set out to show that these beliefs are reasonable, that we have good reasons for accepting them, no good reasons to not accept them, such that if your mind is working properly and you're relatively unbiased, you would accept the conclusion of these arguments. Is that fair? That's the goal. Okay, very good. So let's move on. At first, is it reasonable to believe, oh, there's the three words. I had pictures of them. I'm sorry. Is it reasonable to believe that God exists? Can a rational person conclude that an omnipotent, omniscient, divine being exists outside the realm of time and space? Again, Dawkins thinks certainly not. He strenuously argued the point in The God Delusion. Chapter 4 of that book is very cleverly titled, Why There Almost Certainly Is No God, and it contains his most robust argument for the irrationality of belief in God. He says, look, you have to be blind to think that there's a God. There's not a shred of evidence for his existence. There's not a single argument that supports his existence. 70 years ago, the 20th century atheistic philosopher Bertrand Russell was once asked in a famous debate, he was asked, what would you do, Mr. Russell, if you stood before God after you die, apart from being really surprised, if when you die you stood before God and God asked you, Bertie, come on, why didn't you believe in me? And Russell said, my answer would be, not enough evidence, sir. Not enough evidence. And so the question is there any evidence, any reason to believe that God exists? Well, with respect to Russell and Dawkins, I want to suggest that there are considerable reasons and evidence available, such that it is actually more reasonable and rational to believe that God exists than to believe that he does not. And to that end, I want to share with you four traditional theistic arguments. These in the medieval period were called proofs for the existence of God. I'm just going to call them arguments for the existence of God. Now, at the outset, a couple of things to note. First, this is just going to be a very brief presentation of each of them. We could spend a lot of time on each of them, and I would love to. I invite you to pursue that during the Q&A, but we're just going to skim the surface at the start. Secondly, skeptics and non-Christians have written a lot of objections to these arguments. We're not going to have time to go into them all. Third, believers, Christian philosophers, have written a lot of responses to those objections against these arguments. We're not going to have time to dive into those as well. So please don't think that I'm saying everything that there is to say about any of these arguments. I'm not. Finally, each of the arguments that I present are members of families of theistic arguments. There's a lot of different variations of them. I'm just going to give you kind of one or two of those. So there's lots of different ways of phrasing these. We're just going to dive into ones as we go. So first is what we call cosmological arguments for the existence of God. Cosmological arguments go from the cosmos, the universe, all that exists, and argue from the cosmos to a creator of the cosmos. So we have Thomas Aquinas. This is from the 13th century, a giant in Christian philosophy, and it works during about five steps. So first he says there is an order of causes in the world. This is very simple to see. We see that thing A causes thing B. I push the button on here and it causes this to go forward or backwards, right? So thing A causes thing B. We see an order of causes in the world. Second, nothing can be the cause of itself. This is very easy for us to understand, right? I did not cause myself to come into being. This did not cause itself to come into being. Nothing is the cause of itself. Hence, everything that is caused by something other than itself. That's pretty straightforward, right? That just follows from the second one. However, there cannot be what we call an infinite regress of causes. Now, I'm not going to show this video, but what this argument says is that there cannot be an actual infinity. You can't trace back causation forever, because to do so would require you to attain an actual infinite series of events. And the argument is that there is no actual infinite series of events. You cannot have an infinite series of causes. So you can always trace back. So it's kind of like, you imagine when you traveled with your kids, when your kids were young, right, and they're asking these questions, Daddy, why is the sky blue? Oh, the sky is blue because of refraction of light and so on. I don't really understand all that, but that's okay. Well, why does light refract? Well, because of this. Well, why is that? Well, because of this. Well, why that? Because of this. Why this? Just because. Right? Eventually, we're not able anymore to trace back the regress of causes. So we can ask, you know, what caused Stanley? Right? Stanley? Okay. What caused Stanley? Well, Stanley's parents. What caused Stanley's parents? Well, their parents. What caused their parents? Well, and we can trace it all the way back, right? But eventually, what's going to happen? We come to ground zero. We come to, as it were, the origin point. Right? If we trace it all the way back, we come to the Big Bang. So eventually, we have to come to something which is a first uncaused cause. Something which is the cause of other things, but is not itself caused by anything else. Why? Because this is the only way to avoid an infinite regress of causes. So we come to this existence of something that causes other things, but is not itself caused. And this, Aquinas says, is God. So God is the first uncaused cause. All right, so that's one variety of a cosmological argument. The second variety is what we call the Kalam cosmological argument. I give you the premises and the conclusion on your handout for you. First one, relatively uncontroversial in some circles, in most circles, the universe began to exist. This premise can be defended philosophically and scientifically. I won't work through the philosophical support for it, but we can certainly talk about it later if we would like to. It can also be supported scientifically, okay? So through Big Bang cosmology, the argument that you come back at whatever point you understand it to be, and that there was a Big Bang event, and that that's what where the universe explodes into existence from a point of nothingness. So the universe began to exist a finite time ago. Second law of thermodynamics also supporting this kind of contention. So philosophical and scientific support for the premise that the universe began to exist, okay? There was a time where there was a point at which the universe did not exist, then the universe did exist. So the universe began to exist. Second premise, anything that begins to exist has a cause outside of itself. Again, we can use any one of us for an example. We can use the pews in this auditorium for an example. Anything that begins to exist is caused by something outside of itself. And if this is the case, then the universe requires an external cause, a cause outside of itself. Well, what can possibly be outside of the universe? Right? It would have to be something that is transcendent, beyond the universe, that is immaterial. It's not made of material stuff. Why? Because it brings material stuff into being and so forth. And again, the conclusion of this argument, it is generally put forth, is God. So the universe is brought into existence by something outside of itself, and that something is God. All right. Was that relatively comprehensible? Okay. We're going to race along, and we're going to look at now ontological arguments. These are probably the most difficult of the theistic arguments to get our minds wrapped around. Again, we're just going to race through this in the interest of time. Ontological arguments are based on ontos or ontology, which is just the study of being, so existence. And the argument here basically is that from the very idea of God, it necessarily follows that God must exist. Now, if that sounds like a philosophical trick to you, you wouldn't be alone. It sounds like a philosophical trick to a lot of people. But it's not. Okay, so let's work through it really quickly. So Anselm in the 11th century is the first one to form this argument. He says, first, understand or think of God. Okay, he says, when you think of God, we all have in mind what he calls that man. Nothing greater can be conceived. Okay? We can't conceive of anything greater than God. We conceive of God as that greatest possible being, or in contemporary theology, it's called maximally great being, which is nicely shortenable to MGB. Right? That than which nothing greater can be conceived is like TTWNGCBC, which does not work at all. But MGB works, so maximally great being. So God is understood as this maximally great being. Nothing can be greater than this being. And Anselm says, everybody understands what we mean by that. Even the person who doesn't believe in God. Okay, so when I'm a teenager and I don't believe in the existence of God, I know what people mean when they say God. I understand the concept, even if I don't believe in him. Okay, so Anselm says, everybody understands what we mean by this concept. Second, Something can exist either just in our understanding or in our understanding and in reality. Okay, so, for example, we can think of horses. There are no horses in this room, but we can all have the idea of horse in our mind. We can also understand that a horse can exist not just in our mind, but also in reality, right? That's simple. How about unicorns? We can all understand the concept of a unicorn. Fair? Right? It's like a horse with a horn. At least that's how I picture it. Do unicorns exist in reality? No. Okay? But we can understand them existing in our mind. Okay? So something can be like a unicorn existing only in our mind, or it can be like a horse existing in our mind and in reality. Fair? If something exists only in our mind, it would be greater if it existed in reality as well. Okay? Any single fellows in the room? Unmarried men? Bachelors? Any unmarried ladies? Oh, we got one! Okay, very good. Okay. So, are you dating, seeing somebody? No. Perfect! Okay, that's perfect. Okay? So, what I want you to do is to think of the perfect woman for you. Okay? It doesn't have to be really worked out all that thoroughly, but just, you got something in mind? Okay, now, let me ask it, was it Chris? Okay, so Chris, would it be better if she existed in reality, or is it better that she just exists in your mind? Better if she existed in reality. Okay, that's the kind of thing we mean when we say it would be better for something to exist in reality, greater for something to exist in reality, as opposed to existing just in our mind, okay? Now, if this is the case, if God only exists in our understanding, then God is not the greatest conceivable being. Why not? Because it would be greater if he existed in reality as well, and not just in our understanding. So if the idea of God only exists in our mind, then he is not that than which nothing greater can be conceived. I can conceive of something greater, namely that being existing not just in here, but in reality as well. But God is, by definition, the greatest conceivable being, the maximally great being. Therefore, he must exist not only in our mind, but also in reality. All right, how many of you are now thoroughly perplexed? You? Okay, good. Be honest. All right. This is a very tricky argument. Usually, when I work through this with one of my classes, it takes about 2 class periods before light bulbs start going on. Okay? So it would not be uncommon at all that this just perplexes you. What I want you to grasp at this point is that this is a traditional, very reasonable argument for the existence of God that works from the concept of God to the existence of God. Okay? If that's all that you grasp at this point, that's fine. Okay? We're going to skip over the other version of the ontological argument just because it is somewhat perplexing. And let's move along to teleological arguments. Now, teleological comes from the word telos, which just means purpose or function. And so teleological arguments are like arguments from purpose or arguments from fine-tuning, arguments from design. Okay, William Paley in the 18th century has kind of the first version of this argument, and his is an argument from analogy. So he says, you consider these two things, and he considers the watch and the universe. He's got the famous little passage about walking through a heath, a field, and stumbling upon a watch. And you look at this watch, and you're like, oh, it has all of these parts. You've never seen one before. It's like the gods must be crazy kind of thing, right? You've never seen a watch before. You stumble across it, and you just notice things about it. And as you notice things about it, you start to draw correlations, analogies between it and other things that have the same kind of characteristics. How to exemplify this? Okay, well, we'll imagine, how many of you are cat owners? Anybody cat owners? Oh, great, you guys are very moral. Well, except for you, I'm sorry. Okay, so you've got a cat, 2 cats? 1 cat? Just 1? Anybody else have a cat? No, just 1 cat in this whole room. That's fascinating. How about dogs? Anybody dog people? 1? Again, just 1? Okay, well, that doesn't work. We'll have to pretend that yours is a cat. Is that okay? Okay, so your dog is a cat. We'll just imagine that for this. Otherwise, the example won't work, okay? So we'll say, for example, that I've never seen a cat before, and I come to both of your houses, okay? So I come to your house, and I see a creature that has fur. And I come to your house, and I see a creature that has fur. And it has 4 legs, 2 ears, this kind of cute little face that nonetheless has evil imprinted into it. So I see these things in these two different critters, that neither of which I have ever seen before, and I say, huh, this must be the same kind of creature as that. Okay? It's got these characteristics in common, therefore it must also have this in common, that they are both called cats. Okay? That's kind of the basic idea of Paley's design argument. I see a watch. It has many parts that work together. It's complex. Okay, the parts aren't just simple. You've got gears, you've got mechanisms. Not our watches today, but his watches then. Okay, it seems to serve a purpose. As I watch it work, watch the watch work, it seems to serve a function or a purpose. And therefore, I can conclude that this watch is probably designed by somebody. Okay, it's got all of these parts that work together in a particular way to serve a particular function. Therefore, I conclude it's probably designed. Why? Because I have experience of things that have many different parts that work together in complex ways to serve particular functions. And in every case, I've seen that those are designed by somebody. Okay? So I see clothing that has different parts that work together to serve a particular function. I see computers. I see engines. I see houses. I see all of these things that have those characteristics in common, and in every case, they're designed by somebody. Therefore, when I see this watch, I conclude the same thing. Now think of the universe. Think of just our world. We see all of these parts that work together in very complex ways to serve a particular function. So what should our conclusion be, he says? It should be that the universe is also designed. Now, there's a more contemporary version of it that is structured in a little bit different way. And it works really from kind of a cosmic fine-tuning scale. Since the fine-tuning of the universe is due either to necessity or to chance or to intelligent design. Those seem to be the only three options available. But the fine-tuning of the universe is not, it's argued, due to either necessity or chance or a combination of those. And whenever you have three choices at the beginning and two of them are eliminated, then as Sherlock Holmes says, whatever you've got left, no matter how implausible it seems to you at the outset, must be the correct answer. In other words, the universe then must be the result of intelligent design. And so a couple of the things that some of the thinkers will point to are things like the initial conditions of the universe, things like the cosmological constant that governs the rate of expansion of the universe, the relationship between strong and weak nuclear force. These are all things that are a little bit outside of my wheelhouse, so they're not things that I fully grasp or understand. But nonetheless, they point to these things, these elements of the universe that have to be precisely so in order for life to be possible anywhere and in order for human life to be possible where it is. So all of these elements of the universe have to be precisely so in order for life to be. What is the likelihood that they are arranged just so by chance? Very, very unlikely. Is there some sort of physical necessity that it has to be this way? Well, no, it doesn't seem that way either. So what are you left with? You're left with this notion of design. Okay, we're going to race through this one. Incidentally, you can also see Frederick Hoyle is not a theist at all. He does not believe in God. Well, he's dead now, so he probably does believe in God. But his conclusion was that a common sense interpretation, when you just look at these constants, you look at the laws that govern the universe, he says, the common sense interpretation, he says, it's not the right one, but the one that appears immediately to you is that somebody's played with this. Somebody has set the dials on the soundboard just so that life is possible. It could not be just a result of chance. Okay, so that in a nutshell is the fine-tuning argument. All sorts of illustrations we could give for it, but we're going to skip over those. Fourth, the moral argument for the existence of God. The argument basically goes like this. If there is no God, then there would be no objective morality. Okay, so if God does not exist, then there is no right and wrong that applies to everybody in all places at all times. There just cannot be. There's nothing to ground it in. We'll talk more about that actually later this morning. However, we do know that objective moral values and duties do exist. We know intuitively that there are some things that are just objectively wrong, some things that ought never to be done, that are never justifiable. And we know that there are some things that are objectively right, that are always right for all people in all places at all times, whether they like it or not, whether they believe it or not. Because of that, we can then conclude that a personal God does exist. This is what's called a modus tollens argument. This is kind of introductory logic, I guess, but it's kind of like an if A, then B, not B, therefore not A. So to think of it, I always encourage my students to think of presidents and assassinations because Americans like killing their presidents for some reason. But you can think of it like this. If Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, then Abraham Lincoln is dead. Okay? If A, then B. Well, let's use a different president. Let's use Reagan. If Reagan was assassinated, then Reagan is dead. But it is false that Reagan is dead, not B. Okay? So if A, if Reagan was assassinated, then B, Reagan is dead. Not B. Reagan is not dead. Oh, Reagan is dead now, isn't he? Clinton. Let's use Clinton. Okay? If Clinton was assassinated, then Clinton is dead. Clinton is not dead. What can we therefore conclude? Not assassinated. There's absolutely no possible way whatsoever that Clinton has been assassinated. Why not? Because we're saying if he'd been assassinated, then for sure, for absolute certainty, he would be dead. If A, then B. Not B, therefore, not A. Okay? It works the other way around as well, incidentally. So if Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated, then Lincoln is dead. Next premise, Lincoln has been assassinated. What can you then conclude? Lincoln is dead. There's no other option. If he's been assassinated, he must be dead. If A, then B, A, therefore B. That's modus ponens. If A, then B, not B, therefore not A, that's modus tollens. This is just a modus tollens argument. If A, then B, therefore not A. The only thing that makes this a little bit tricky is that it works with a double negative, okay? If A, if God does not exist, then B, objective morals do not exist. Not B, it is not true that objective morals do not exist. In other words, objective morals do exist. Okay, take out the double negative. Therefore, it is not true that God does not exist. Okay, I see some perplexed looks again, but I see a couple of nods, a couple of light bulbs. That's encouraging. To defend this argument, you've got to work through and establish that there is some sort of object of morality. That's the first step, okay? This actually isn't that hard to do. We're not going to chase through this. But there are lots of arguments in our society today that, you know, right and wrong is just a matter of personal opinion or cultural standards, that there is no object of right and wrong. People say morals are relative to individual or to society. If you push hard enough, if you push strongly enough, people will collapse moral relativism and say, no, there are some things that are just plain wrong. Have to do is an example that you know they're going to agree with. Today, rape would be one of those. Slavery would be another. Genocide would be another. Okay, is genocide wrong? Is it objectively wrong? I hesitate to say never, but I don't think you're going to find somebody in our society who will say, oh, no, genocide could be right. It could be okay. I can see that being all right. He's just not going to find that, right? We're all going to acknowledge that universally it is wrong. Okay. So once you establish that objective morality exists, then you have to talk about, well, what can we ground it in? Now we're looking at the first premise. Is it the case that if God doesn't exist, there can't be objective morality? Another way of phrasing that is that there can only be objective morality if God does exist. Okay. Can you ground objective morality in something like evolution? Well, no. Why not? Because evolution, by definition, is constant change. And if there's constant change, how can there be an unchanging moral standard within that? Well, there can't be. Can you ground it in culture? Well, no, because culture changes as well. And cultures are different from one another. Can you ground it in government and law? Well, no, because governments change and laws change. Supreme Court of the United States, just, what, yesterday, day before, whatever, legalized gay marriage across the nation. This would have been absolutely unthinkable even just 10 years ago in the United States. And so laws change, governments change, okay? Object of morality, by definition, does not change. So object of morality cannot be grounded in something that, by definition, changes. All right, so again, if God does not exist, object of morals do not exist, but object of morals do exist, therefore God must exist as well. Okay, so again, these are just four traditional theistic arguments that point to the existence of God. There's been lots and lots and lots written about each one of them. The point that I want to drive home right now is that, at the very least, these show that there are reasonable arguments that point to the existence of God. Some people might debate them, and they might say, well, I don't think that argument actually holds. Well, now you've got a conversation. But guess what? If you've got a conversation about whether the argument works or not, you're arguing about reasons and evidence, which shows that there are reasons and evidence that Christians can invoke for their belief in the existence of God. The only objection might be that, well, they're not good enough reasons or it's not good enough evidence. But then we can talk about it, right? So there are, at the very least, arguments and evidence that can be used to support the belief in the existence of God. When you put the arguments together, these four families of arguments, I actually think it makes a very compelling case for the actual existence of the God of the Bible. Each of them individually only does a part, but putting them together, I think, makes a very, very strong case. Okay, I want to race through, and we'll do this probably in about 5 minutes or so, okay? Belief in the resurrection of Christ. Now, you might think, 5 minutes, and you're going to defend the resurrection. Well, okay, we're just going to scratch the surface, and we're going to look at a couple of things really, really briefly. What I want to lay out is 6 historical facts, okay? Now, when I say historical facts, what I mean is that these are things that are generally accepted by ancient historians as actually being the case. Okay, so these are things that historians agree about. Jesus died on a cross. Yeah. Okay? So these are facts that are agreed to by the vast majority of historians. The question is, what best explains these facts? My argument is that it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ that best explains these facts. Now, I have a whole course that we do just this, so obviously we're not doing this in much detail, right, if we're doing it in 5 minutes. But 6 facts that point towards the to Jesus Christ. And the question that you want to ask yourself is, can anything else account for these facts better than the resurrection? Okay. So the first one, that Jesus died on a cross. Mel Gibson made a movie of it, so it has to be true, right? That just obviously follows. So the Gospels, it's outside the Gospels. You have it in Roman historians. You have it in Jewish historians. You have it in Greek historians. You have it everywhere. The only place you don't have it is in Muslims today. And they're relying on a book that is written 600 years after the fact that says Jesus didn't actually die on the cross. So, do you want to go with sources that are written early, or do you want to go with something written 600 years later by people who didn't live anywhere near the place or the time that they happened? Historians are going to say you go with the early sources. Okay? So Jesus died on a cross. This is accepted by virtually everybody. Second, Jesus is buried in a tomb. Now you might think, well, duh, okay, people die, people are buried. Well, this one is objected to by some. They say, well, maybe Jesus wasn't buried. Maybe his body was just thrown in a common grave. Crossan, who I did my dissertation on, he's one of those few that argues Jesus wasn't buried. But by and large, again, it's accepted. The empty tomb, accepted by over 2/3 of scholars, which I think is actually remarkable given the importance that the empty tomb has. Gospels all present it. Early Jewish literature in the 1st and 2nd centuries accept it. This is still the argument the Jews are bringing forth in the year 150 AD. So 120 or so years after the death of Jesus. Jews are saying, yeah, he was buried, but somebody stole the body. Well, you can only steal the body if there's a body to be stolen, right? So the tomb is found empty, and Jews are saying, yeah, the tomb is empty because you guys stole the body. So we find this first in Matthew 28, right, where the Jewish leaders concoct a story. Okay, the body's gone. What are we going to do? We're going to make up the story that the disciples came during the night and stole the body. Okay? So that's why the tomb is found empty, because the body was stolen. Fourth fact, disciples claim to see the risen Jesus. Now, it's important to note, this does not say the disciples saw the risen Jesus. The claim is that the historical fact is that the disciples claim that they saw Jesus risen to life after his death. A claim to have seen something is different than actually having seen something. We've got to just make that distinction. So what historians agree is that the disciples thought they saw him, and the disciples say they saw him. What historians do not necessarily agree on is that the disciples actually saw him. Because if the disciples actually saw him after his death, what does that mean? It means that he was risen from the dead for them to have seen. Okay? And historians, by and large, do not agree on that. Okay, so they agree that the disciples claim to have seen the risen Jesus. We can go through 1 Corinthians 15, right, where Paul traces through the list of witnesses of the resurrection. All 4 of the Gospels contain this claim. Acts chapter 9, early church fathers, you find it throughout. So again, this is really not much in doubt. It's interesting to note the types of appearances that we have. Groups, not just individuals. Okay, large groups, a group of over 500 at a time. What does that mean? That means it's not hallucination. Because if we both smoke some magic mushrooms, we're going to see visions, we're going to see hallucinations, but we ain't going to see the same thing. Right? Hallucinations are not shared by groups. So what this means is that if he appears to groups, that we're not dealing with hallucinations here. He also appears to James, his skeptical half-brother. which means he's not just appearing to people who were disciples during his lifetime, the people who thought he was nuts, and literally Jesus' brothers thought he was nuts. They thought he was crazy. He was out of his mind during his earthly ministry. And you have the skeptic now become a believer on the basis, so we're told, of the risen Jesus appearing to him. Paul, who is persecuting the church, and we read in Acts chapter 9 that the risen Jesus appears to Paul, and that Paul now becomes a follower, from opponent to proponent, from skeptic to believer. Right? So you have appearances to all sorts of different groups. Oh, yes, and they're unapologetically bodily. Okay, these are bodily appearances. They're not just some kind of ghost, some kind of vision, some kind of mental image. They're very bodily appearances. Remember in John chapter 20, right, when he appears to Thomas and he says to Thomas, here, buddy, come on, put your fingers in there if you want to. Okay, it's a body that appears. He eats fish in John chapter 21. He breaks bread in Luke chapter 24. This is not some kind of ghost. The emphasis is the disciples are claiming that they've seen a risen body, not just some kind of ghost. All right, fifth, the disciples are transformed. They're a little bit scared after the arrest of Jesus, right? We all remember that. Well, because they run away, yes? And they're hiding. They hide in the upper room for fear of the Jews, right? In Matthew, where are we? There we go, John chapter 20. Okay, they're hiding in the upper room for fear of the Jews. Peter denies even knowing Jesus. He calls down curses on himself. He swears, literally, I don't know the man. Why? Because they're scared that what's happening to Jesus was going to happen to them. So they're petrified. They're absolutely terrified. And what happens? After they say that they've seen the risen Jesus, they become fearless instead of fearful. Okay? They become bold. And they continue to preach even to their death. We're told by history, we can't confirm with all of them, but we're told that all but John suffer martyrdom for their faith. Now here's the question. Do you die for what you know to be a lie? Would you die for something that you know to be false? Now, we might die for something that is false, but not if we know that it's false. We're just not wired that way. Particularly when you're talking again about a group of people. It doesn't take very long. If say they perpetrated a hoax, right? They stole the body, made the whole thing up. It doesn't take long for one of them to turn and to say, okay, don't kill me. I admit it. We made it all up. It was John and Peter's idea. Go get them. It doesn't take long. Under the threat of physical force, death, humiliation, whatever the case may be, it doesn't take long for somebody to say, okay, you're right. We just made it all up. Even if it was actually true, it doesn't take long for somebody to cave in under that kind of pressure. But you do not see that with the early Christians. Okay? They're transformed. They die for what they profess to be the truth. And then finally, the sixth fact is that we have the early preaching in Jerusalem, which is the center of the Jewish nation. It's not kind of a backwater. You have the religious leaders around. You have the Sanhedrin. You have the Pharisees. And you have the preaching of the resurrection in Jerusalem within 7 weeks of the professed event. Now, if the body of Jesus is rotting away in a grave somewhere, what's going to happen at that point? Somebody goes and gets the body and trots it out and says, here's your risen Messiah. Okay, it's early enough that you can still do that. So you have the public preaching at a very early date. When you put all of that together, what do? The best explanation I would submit to you is that Jesus was raised bodily from the dead. Okay? Now again, lots more has been written about that. We can say a lot more about that. There are alternative hypotheses that people bring forward, but all of them run into difficulties at one place or another. So Kenneth Humphreys, a very bitter atheist blogger, once objected to Gary Habermas in a public debate, and he said this: there is not even a shred of evidence that supports the Christian belief that Jesus was raised from the dead. To be blunt, Humphreys is in denial. He just refuses to acknowledge the evidence that is right in front of him. He's kind of like the naive husband who says, there's no evidence that my wife is cheating on me. And his friends are bringing him pictures and texts and emails and graphic photos of her involved with another man, and he refuses to look at them. He says, no, that's just not true. There's no evidence that she's cheating on me. He's just being willfully blind to the evidence. Well, that's kind of how Humphreys is with regards to the resurrection. There's not a shred of evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead. There's all sorts of evidence. You might not agree with where that evidence leads, but at least be honest and acknowledge there are reasons and evidence to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. Okay, we've raced through a lot. I've not gotten through everything that I wanted to get through. You'll see on the back that there's still a couple of things that I wanted to talk about that we didn't get to. I will say one word about faith-seeking understanding, and that's with regards to salvation, which you cannot see these texts either. I want to submit to you that faith and reason are friends, and I want to draw for you kind of a picture. So consider coming to Christ as it were as a faith event. Okay? Some will say that becoming a Christian has to be and can only be about blind faith. I beg to differ. So imagine with me that you're going mountain climbing. And you're climbing, I don't know what, I don't mountain climb because I'm petrified of heights. I like hiking because I can see the solid ground in front of me. But imagine you're mountain climbing, you're climbing up a sheer face, and all of a sudden a winter storm blows in, you're caught unawares, you weren't expecting it, and you've got like nowhere to go. You're like, oh dear. And you try to get up a little higher, you try to move, you try to find yourself a ledge or something to wait out the storm, and you can't find anything. Okay? Now imagine with me two scenarios. First scenario, you hear a voice that you don't recognize calling very faintly, jump, you'll make it. Jump. Okay, you don't recognize the voice, you don't know who it is, you have no idea whether you should trust this voice or not. What do you do? Okay, that's kind of the scenario that the skeptic says Christianity is. Make this blind leap of faith. Okay, somebody somewhere says that it will turn out well for you in the end. And so take this blind leap of faith. Imagine another scenario. Okay, same thing, you're climbing this mountain face, storm blows in, you're done for. And you've kind of climbed around looking for a ledge and you can't find one. And all of a sudden you hear a voice. And the voice says, Aaron, I can see you. I know you can't see me, but I can see you. I'm only 4 feet from you on your right-hand side. You can't walk from there to me, but if you jump, I got you. I'll catch you. I'll help you get here. There's a ledge big enough for the both of us. Aaron recognizes the voice as mine. He knows whose voice it is. He understands the content of what's being said. Does he still have to take, as it were, a leap of faith? Yes. Right? Why? Because I'm telling him to do something that he can't fully see. He cannot see where I am. He can't see the ledge that I'm on. He has to trust that I am telling him the truth and not just, you know, hoping to inherit his millions. Right? He has to trust that I'm telling him the truth, and he has to take that step or that leap of faith. But it's not a blind leap of faith anymore. He recognizes the voice, and he has good reason to trust that voice. That, I submit to you, is much more like what Christianity is about. It's not about taking a blind, unreasonable leap of faith into an unknown darkness. It's about seeing that there is good reason and good evidence for that and trusting in what is beyond that. No, we can't see all the way to the cross, as it were. But we can see enough that it's no longer a blind leap of faith that we're taking, but rather a reasoned step of faith. Does that illustration kind of help, kind of make sense? Look, it still requires faith. No one comes to Christ without faith, right? But it's not a faith that is unreasonable, irrational, or just blind. We have good reason for taking the step of faith that we do. Okay, that's all that we got the time to work through right now. Questions, thoughts, comments? What do you want to pursue a little further? There's, I hope, a lot of different things that we could go through.
Okay, thank you very much. My head's swimming a little bit, but thank you for that. Giving us lots of good stuff to think about. So, let's take a few minutes for questions. Just to point out, too, even if we don't get to questions, we do have time. In our Sunday school class tomorrow morning, we will be, Dr. Anderson will be with us, and that will be pretty much a whole morning of or an hour or so of questions and answers. So we have time too. If you need some time to digest what's going on here, and if tonight as you're trying to get to sleep and you're tossing and turning and wondering about what was said, if you come up with a question, write it down and bring it tomorrow. We will have a chance to get to them tomorrow as well. So any questions here? Okay. Can you do it on the microphone? Or?
Sorry, I'm not too sure if this is a stupid question.
Oh,
but
there's very few stupid questions, though.
Yeah, I'm just dying to know, how do you respond to people who say, yeah, I believe there's a God, you know, and there's a God of the universe, God of goodness and stuff, and so that's why I find my own God, you know, in Muslim or in, you know, whatever other religion.
Yeah, excellent. So I believe in some sort of God. Okay, so these theistic arguments maybe are helpful. They show me that there is something beyond our universe that brought us into being. But why does it have to be the God of Christianity? Why can't I just make it up myself? That's the primary reason for the second half of the argument with the resurrection of Christ. Because in my mind, if God has raised Jesus from the dead, Christianity is true, period. Now, the primary reason for that is that Christ proclaims himself to be the Son of God during his earthly ministry, right? He says, before Abraham was born, I am. I have authority to forgive sin. I have authority to heal. I have divine authority to teach God's truth. So these are the things Jesus says about himself. And if God raises him from the dead, then that's at least an implicit and probably an explicit affirmation of who Jesus thought he was. Okay? So if God raised Jesus from the dead, everything changes. Okay, it's not just some ambiguous, unknown God out there. It's God, the Father of Jesus Christ. Does that help a little bit? I guess what I'm trying to say is I want to bring the discussion to the person of Jesus. Okay, if they acknowledge that there is a God, that's good. Okay, but it's not enough. Right? Which God exists? And lots of people in our society want it to be kind of a designer God or a buffet God. I go and I pick and I choose what God I believe in. That's all fine and dandy if there is no such thing as truth. But if there is something such as truth, well, then it matters which God. It's not just a matter of believing in God, it's which God. So if we can look at the person and the work of Jesus Christ and the arguments for the resurrection, then I think that helps to establish that it's not just God, but it's the God of Jesus Christ. That's where I try to turn the conversation, is let's look at Jesus. Follow up, feel free to... I think you're right. So, again, for those that couldn't hear, it's easy for us who believe in Jesus, you know, to see that as part of it. But for somebody who has no background, no knowledge of who Jesus is, it's hard to bring Jesus into the conversation. Yeah, that's kind of the heart of it. And I agree. I think it is. I think it is hard. I don't think there's any way around that. This is one of the places where I think Keller is a good help, okay, and the reason for God. He's got all sorts of other works as well, which are very approachable. And Keller explicitly is trying to minister to skeptics and religiously minded people who aren't Christians in New York City, where kind of the buffet God is like the style, right? So that's kind of his heart, is to help bring those into the conversation. I have personal experience with that difficulty as well. I'm the only Christian in my family. That can be a difficult place to be. And the last time that I at least explicitly tried to point the conversation in the direction of Jesus, it did not go well, right? And so it's kind of a situation where, you know, my mom was brought up within the church but walked away from it, okay? So she rejected it when she hit college and wanted nothing more to do with the faith of her parents. And so we were, I think it was at one of her birthdays and the family was gathered, and she was driving us through her hometown where she grew up, and she says, well, there's the church that we went to. Aha, here's an opening, right? An open door. So, well, Mom, why did you stop? Why did you stop going to church? And she just kind of commented, and this will sound familiar, I think. She said, you know, I got to university and I realized that really all religions kind of basically teach the same thing. And so as long as you know you try to be good and you believe in God generally, then you're going to be okay. And I'm like, well, do religions really all teach the same thing? You know, Jesus seems to me a little bit unique. And then the next words out of my mom's mouth were, would you look at the bird on the top of that tower? And, you know, so, yeah, oftentimes, look, you might try to push conversation in that direction, and it's just not going to go there. you can't control that. All you can try to do is be faithful to the opportunities that God gives you. So, yeah, I feel that struggle.
Hey, I wanted to ask, like, are there more historical accounts of the resurrection of Christ, like from other sources outside of the Bible? All the disciples and the groups of people claim to see him after his death.
Yeah.
Did they write about this in other documents that were discovered later on?
So the people that Jesus appeared to, did they write other things apart from what we have in our New Testament? Yeah, the short answer to that, at least as far as I know, is no, they did not. Or at least if they did, they're in writings that we just don't have. Okay. And this would not be uncommon at all. We know that the Apostle Paul wrote a lot more than we have in our New Testament. He tells us in Corinthians, he tells us about the first letter that he's written to them. Well, that's in 1 Corinthians. So obviously there was something that he wrote to that church before what we know as 1 Corinthians. Most scholars also think there was a letter written in between 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. So we know that Paul wrote a lot of letters, and we don't have all of them. Okay, we can assume the same thing about any number of the other apostles and disciples, that they would have written other things that just were not preserved. It's hard to estimate, but certainly not all of what was written in the first century was kept. Okay, in fact, there are some early opponents of Christianity that the only reason that we know that they wrote something is because Christians tell us about what they wrote. And Christians sometimes preserved what they wrote in their responses to those people. So the short answer is no. The fuller answer is that you have accounts of them in later Christians. So, for example, Polycarp, who writes, if I remember correctly, kind of somewhere between 95 and 110, is understood usually to be a disciple of the Apostle John. And Polycarp writes about things that John taught him. Okay? Now, Polycarp's writings we don't have. But we have Polycarp's writings preserved for us in the writings of later Christians. So what you have there is, say, a second century Christian recording what Polycarp wrote about what John taught him. Does that make sense? So that's the kind of thing that we do have. We don't have, as it were, first century writings of the disciples outside of what we have in the New Testament. Yeah. Yeah. And so you have a number of those kinds of writings. So there's a great book, I think it's by Robert Van Voorst, V-O-O-R-S-T, and it's called Jesus Outside the New Testament. And he kind of tries to, I apologize if I got the author's name wrong, but the book is called Jesus Outside the New Testament. And he basically tries to catalog everything that is written in secular history about the early Christian movement in the first century. And so that would be a more exhaustive treatment. So I'm just going off the top of my head and bringing some of these to mind. But you have Josephus, who writes just after the Jewish Wars in the 70s. So he's writing about 75 AD. And there are a couple of significant passages in Josephus, one about Jesus, one about the early Christians, one about James, the brother of Jesus, who is martyred for his faith. So you have those types of writings, and in those, you know, Josephus notes that James is martyred because of his belief in his brother being the Messiah. You have Tacitus, who is a Roman historian. You've got, why do the names escape me when they're important? Lucian of Samosata, who is a Greek. He's a playwright, so he's not a historian, but he's kind of a satirist, so he's making fun of Christianity by writing about it after the fact. You have Trajan, Pliny. You have Pliny, who writes to Trajan about the early Christians, and Pliny's kind of writing, you know, should I keep, you know, hunting down these Christians and killing them, because none of them are bothering to turn away from their faith, no matter how many I kill. So is it really worth it? So you have those kinds of things in secular history that again give us the confidence, even if you took away the New Testament entirely, which no historian wants to do. Because the New Testament generally is considered to be the best historical evidence we have for the life of Jesus. Even if you're just from a totally secular perspective, an atheistic perspective, the New Testament documents are still the best documents, the best historical sources you have for the life, ministry, death, and postmortem fate of Jesus. If I remember correctly, I think we worked through some of that in more detail last summer, the reasons why people hold it to be more historically reliable. But even if you set aside the New Testament, you would still have enough in secular history to be able to kind of put together the primary trajectory of Jesus' life. Okay, so his virgin birth, his miracles, his healings, his death, the professed visions of his being risen from the dead, and the fact that opponents said the disciples stole the body. So you'd still have enough to kind of piece that together. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe just before we get to the next question, maybe I can just clarify there. There really is no doubt that Jesus lived and died on the earth, right? Like everyone, that's pretty much an agreed fact, isn't
it?
Would that be true to say just simply that?
Yes, although, I mean, if you go online, you can find what you call Jesus myth, or Jesus mythicists who argue that Jesus never existed.
Sure, you can find anything.
I could write a book today that said Adolf Hitler never existed, and, you know, yeah, people can write stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, no respectable scholar today, let's put it that way, no respectable scholar who has academic credentials and studies in the field would argue that Jesus never existed. It would be like somebody in a scientific field saying gravity just doesn't exist. There is no theory of gravity.
Yeah. I think Stanley had a question.
I guess the evidence that you presented is good, but not overwhelming. And I always wonder why God doesn't give overwhelming evidence, such that even Bertrand Russell could not deny it. Like, why don't we find a cave in the Middle East with a stack of DVDs that's carbon dated to be 4,000 years old with images of the resurrection? I mean, there'd be very little room for anyone to intellectually doubt it at that point. Do you think it's because God wants us to find him with our hearts and not just with our heads?
Yeah. In short, I think you're exactly right. I do think that. To expand on it a little bit, there are some who will actually use, this is called the hiddenness of God. Okay, if God exists, why doesn't he make it more plain, more obvious? And some skeptical philosophers will actually use this as an argument against the existence of God. You know, if God existed, it should be more obvious. It should be written in the sky. I find it written in the sky, incidentally. But, it should be written in the sky such that any rational person cannot reasonably deny his existence. And so they'll say, but because we don't have that kind of evidence, therefore God doesn't exist, which I kind of shake my head and wonder. And, yeah, I do think it's precisely that. I think it's that, where is it? It's in, is it in Isaiah or Jeremiah? One of those two big prophets that we read, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Right? In other words, if you desire to find me, you will find me. But if you desire to deny me, I will give you that out. I'll give you that out. And it'll be a rational option. Okay? It's not that, so when you look at a Richard Dawkins, it's not that Dawkins is irrational. It's not that he's stupid. It's not that he's, he is blind to some degree. But it's not that he's dumb. It's not that he's evil. Right? It's that he doesn't desire God. He desires not God. I had a slide. I took it out from Thomas Nagel, who is an atheist philosopher, teaches at New York University. Yeah, NYU. One of the preeminent philosophers in American philosophy today. And he writes in his book, The Last Word, he says, when I talk about my fear of religion, I'm not just talking, he says, about my fear that Christians are going to do something evil. Because everybody has that kind of fear. No, what I mean is I fear that it might actually be true. So some of the smartest people I know are Christians. That bothers me. He says, I don't want the world to be like that. That's my fear of religion. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Okay, so this is, I think, where we come back to that heart issue, right? So if that's one's perspective, I don't want the world to be such that there is a God. Well, guess what? They are going to find reasons to believe not God. Okay. So, yes, I agree. I think there are good reasons and good evidence to believe in God, but I think you can be perfectly rational in believing that God does not exist, And the evidence and the reasoning are not overwhelming. They're not what I would call rationally compelling in the sense that they compel belief, right? Like, I'm really compelled to believe that you all exist. Okay, I really don't have a rational option about that. I could believe that you don't exist, but I'd really have to shut off every reasonable faculty that I have in order to believe that. Belief in the existence of God is not rationally compelling in that sense. I do think it's rationally persuasive in the sense that, again, and this is the way I kind of laid it out at the beginning, I think that the preponderance of evidence and reasons points to God, such that if one were able to approach it in an unbiased fashion and just look at the reasons and the arguments at their face value, one would be led to conclude God. Okay? However, I don't think all other things are equal, and given the preponderance of sin within the human heart and the human mind, we don't come at things from a neutral perspective, right? If we are Christians, we come at things from a very Christian perspective. And so when I look at the moral argument, I'm like, yeah, like, God, see? Again, God. But if I come at things from an atheistic perspective, then everything is read through a lens of suspicion. So, yeah. Another way of putting it, and I forget, it might have been Gregory Boyd that put it this way, God is not in the business of rational rape. He's not going to force someone to believe in him if they don't want to. So, and so I should have just kept the short answer. I agree. But.
I'd just like to thank you and Stanley. I think your illustration earlier about the cliff situation where you hear a voice, and I think what Stanley is saying, you know, I think maybe that little bit of faith that we're talking about is about the heart. And, you know, we hear the voices, we have these evidences, we know it, but we still need to put our heart out there to believe.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, too, like, are there any other, you talked about the documents, books. Are there books then about the recommendation of books about the truth of the documents of the gospel, right? If you can recommend those. And I remember years ago, many years ago, reading about the resurrection. Who moved the stone? Are there any other books that have come since then?
Yeah. Okay, so on the first question, a couple of books that I would recommend. F.F. Bruce, who has passed away now, but in the 1950s, he wrote a little book, about 80 pages long, called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? It's excellent. It's phenomenal. It's still a classic. Yeah. Craig Blomberg has a much longer, about yay thick, book called The Historical Reliability of the Gospels, and it is also excellent. Richard Baucham, the last name is B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, has an even more difficult book to read, which is called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And his book, the purpose of it is to show that what we have in the gospel, and Richard Baucham is not an evangelical Christian. He's kind of a mainline Christian. So he'll agree on the central elements of the faith, but he'll have lots of differences of opinion with somebody like me. And his purpose is to show that what we have in the Gospels shows itself to be eyewitness testimony of people that were there and saw the things that they're professing to have seen, heard the things they're professing to have heard, and so on. It's excellent. It's really, really good work. So those would be probably my top three. So F.F. Bruce, The New Testament Documents, Are They Historically Reliable? Craig Blomberg, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels, and Richard Baucham, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. On the resurrection, man, there is so much good stuff. Yeah, I mean, obviously my dissertation would be phenomenal to read, but better works to read would be Michael Licona. The last name is L-I-C-O-N-A, and his book is just called The Resurrection of Jesus. The subtitle is A New Historiographical Approach, so don't try to remember that, just The Resurrection of Jesus by Michael Licona. N.T. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, British scholar, phenomenal scholar, very meticulous, detailed scholar. He has a 700-page book that began as a one chapter in an earlier book, and it's called The Resurrection of the Son of God. And it, in my estimation, is the single best one book defending the historical resurrection of Jesus. And Wright is another British Anglican scholar and author. But just phenomenal. He's got that wonderful British voice that you can listen to him lecture all day kind of thing. Those would probably be the top two that I would point to. William Lane Craig has a much shorter book called The Sun Rises, the S-O-N Rises, and it's much easier to work through. He kind of takes this, you know, here's the historical facts that everybody agrees on. Now what do you do with those facts kind of thing? So that's the kind of approach that he takes with it. N.T. Wright takes a very, very different approach, but just as effective in my estimation. Does that help some? Did you get all the names? I'm happy to put those down for you afterwards if you want. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, just don't let me forget because I will. Okay.
Okay, let's take a break for, what, about 10, yeah. 15 minutes? Get up and stretch, have a washroom break, and then we'll come back just after 11, and we'll listen to your next.
Dive into evil.
Yeah, thank you. Dive into evil. Isn't that an interesting topic? So. Yeah.